as you are when I count to five.
One.
Oh, man, you better step.
Two.
You can do better than that.
Three.
Man, will you move aside?
Four.
And let me get out there and do my job.
Gentlemen, let's get ready to rumble!
As you've heard probably already, John Bonanno, who's going to more or less be the standard bearer for Huxley, Aldous, and we have from the other side of the country, out in California, Gordon Comstock, who has been on a couple of times, and not that John hasn't to speak to Huxley, but Gordon's obviously been on a bit more, and he's speaks to George Orwell. Now, truthfully, this whole situation, as I look at it and have thought about it the last couple of days, there's a place for both of these, and maybe you guys are going to figure it out and tell us how this all fits, because I think both warnings are probably either in session right now or soon to be. But before anything else, I want to kick it off with this quote, and John will go to you first, and then you, Gordon. And this is a quote from William Davies in the New Statesman, August 2005. Who, we sometimes ask at the dinners and debates of the intelligentsia, was the 20th century's more insightful prophet, Aldous Huxley or George Orwell? Each is best known for his dystopian fantasy, Huxley's Brave New World, Orwell's 1984, and both feared where modern technology might lead for authorities and individuals alike. But while Huxley anticipated a world of empty pleasures and excessive convenience, Orwell predicted ubiquitous surveillance and the eradication of freedom. Who was right? I think there's probably a third choice in here, too, but John, go ahead, run with that if you would. Who was right?
Well, it depends on how you look at it and where you live. If you live in North Korea, who do you think you would say is right?
Orwell.
Orwell. If you live in the United States, who would you say is right?
I can make an argument for both, but I would tell you because of the pleasure situation, we're just going to use that as a generalism. If we're looking in that sense, we would think of Huxley.
A little more Huxley, although with the since George Bush and justification of torture, maybe we're heading more back towards Orwell in this country. But yeah, I think it depends on where you are and what the situation is. But I think the forces of evil, that is, totalitarianism, will use any strategy they can to obtain their ends. Although, I think some of them probably enjoy the old-fashioned Orwellian system just for fun than they would Huxley's system.
Yeah, and it's probably cheaper, too. So, but anyway, what do you think, Gordon? Who was right, who was wrong? Are they both right, they both wrong, or somewhere
in
between?
They're both right, of course. But, you know, I'm going to side more so with Orwell. I've broken down both of their most famous dystopian novels, 1984 and Brave New World. And I went through them with a pretty fine-tooth comb, I thought, and I came up with what I thought were pretty solid findings of 33 solid, in the case of 1984, 33 that I could identify predictions, or if not predictions, at least identifications of things that would be more so in the future, in 1984, 33, and I found 19 in Brave New World. Now, there could be one or two, I think. That could be my margin of error, two or three each, but I think 33 to 19 is what I came up with. You know, and again, you know, real simple litmus test that I come back to, and I figured this out listening to the Collins brothers and a few others who were touting that Aldous Huxley was the more prophetic, and he definitely was prophetic, definitely. But it comes down to 9/11. That's the litmus test that I've identified.
Mm-hmm.
If you think that 9/11 was perpetrated by 19 Muslim hijackers, then you're going to think that Aldous Huxley was the more prophetic. If you think, as 1984 predicted, that there are going to be more and more false flag attacks where elements of your own evil government are attacking your own people to foment bloodlust within the populace, then you're going to say, okay, Orwell was the most, a little bit more prophetic.
Also, and I do remember when you published that, and I think that's in one of the e-zines, is it not, Gordon?
It is, but I've tried opening it a couple of times since then, and I think there's a virus in it because it bugs out my computer each time.
All right, well, I'll check it out using John's. No, but 3319, fine. But and everybody understands also that it isn't necessarily what's more numerous, but you could have one that is much more of a killer.
That's
true. Yeah. Now, I did want to ask you this question to both of you, and I'm just going to move it to the front from what John had just said about where you live, et cetera. And I'm not really kidding too much about saying totalitarian is cheaper. But, you know, if you're going to be into a pleasure dome society, I think you kind of have to have the money for the excesses. And in some cases, they're not excesses anymore when you think about pharmacology. So at any rate, I'm throwing it to you first, Gordon, and then to John, and that is we look now, and you can align it with Orwell's three spheres. And by the way, that is not such an uncommon element of some futuristic works. I would even say one of them predates Orwell by almost 40 years. However, we take a look at the United States, United Kingdom amalgamation, which obviously is very true, and we look at Russia and China. All right, so we have three countries. We have what you might call a benign socialism with capitalism in the United States and in the UK. And if you want to throw Canada in, you can. And we have two different versions, I think you could say, of communism. Both leaders, Stalin and Mao, call themselves socialists. But let's get down to what it really is. And therefore, do we look at Russia as being a soft communism, where where China now, I think, considers itself, and probably rightly so, as being the more dogmatic, more Stalinist-type communist. So there's three spheres there. What I would ask you first, Gordon, is take these three and tell me which one bespeaks more of Orwell and what he warned us about in Huxley.
You mean the fact that we do see three geopolitical blocks, that's Orwell who predicted that. And I would see, and it's of course the first one you identified is Oceania, America and Canada and England and Australia. And then there's Eurasia, which is which is Europe, continental Europe, along with Russia, right, or at least Western Russia. Mm-hmm. And then you have East Asia was the last power block, which was China and the surrounding nations around China. And I would say anything geopolitically, Orwell was the better prophet, but when you get into this predicting science and the scientific things like for example pharmaceuticals, the rampant pharmaceuticals, Orwell didn't have any feel for the pulse of that. That was all Huxley. Geopolitically, that was Orwell.
Okay. Have you closed out your comments? I'll throw it to John then.
Yeah, closed.
Okay, John.
Okay, so we're looking at like China, Russia, United States as like the three elements.
Yeah, I also call them laboratories.
Yeah, I mean, looking at them, I don't know if you can specifically say any one of them any more reflects an Orwellian or a Huxleyan vision of the totalitarian state. Both Orwell and Huxley presented to us totalitarian states. And I've been thinking a lot about the similarities more than the differences between Orwell and Huxley. If you read 1984, there's the people running things were almost, you could almost see them drifting into a Brave New World type thing as projected into the future. whereas the proles, all the people that did all the work, were kind of almost ignored in that book. They really were like faceless entities, and we never really got to meet them too much or understand what their motivations were, other than they had simple needs and pleasures. Whereas, you know, like getting back to which country represents what, it's almost like a shifting thing. It's almost like it doesn't really matter. The totalitarian scheme, the anti-freedom, the anti-individual scheme, seems to shape-shift on us. You know, if it needs to stomp you in the face with a boot, well, it'll do that. If it can get your acquiescence by putting you on a prescription drug that will, at the same time, calm down your, you know, keep you from being a little exuberant in life, and at the same time make you feel good, they'll use that. If they want to work on an approach over time by changing our actual genetic structure, they're going to do that. It's like, I'm really coming to think that the masters will use any technique they can. Now, do they want to use the violent technique, which isn't so much a projection. I mean, Orwell's 1984 wasn't so much a prediction of the future. He was looking at things that were happening at the time. He saw what was happening in Germany, had happened in Germany just a few years before he wrote, and what was happening in Stalinist Russia as he wrote. And he could use that. I mean, people, you know, who lived in Russia at the time and got to read that book said, how did he know all about us? So a lot of it wasn't so much prediction as projection of what was actually going on in his world, whereas I think Huxley was into more of a science fiction thing. So I don't know.
That he was being deliberately more fictional?
I think Huxley was trying to project into a future more than Orwell. Orwell was just, I think, not just, but I mean, he was observing what was happening contemporaneously in his life. And he was saying, this could get stronger and stronger, because he saw the tendencies in his own England to go to the totalitarian system, which is one of the reasons he ran away to Jura, where he died. He wanted to get away from totalitarian tendencies. And so he figured, well, I can return to the land, to this damp, cold island in Scotland, and maybe I'll, you know. I think he had a feeling he knew he was dying anyways, but...
Let me throw this out to you, and I just want to get this out as a point of information. Nobody's ever really taken me up on the suggestion, but I'll still say it, because there's something going on here, and it relates also to Orwell and Huxley and where they grew up and were educated, and especially the first half of the 20th century. Something was going on in the city of London, in London, and the London School of Economics, where a lot of futuristic prophecies and statements were being made, as if the brain trust was there deciding what would be the best future for the world. And, I mean, it's the old statement, too, about, you know, it's a white man's burden to rule the world. Now, having said that, what I wanted to remind you folks about, one, is that Robert U. Benson wrote a book called Lord of the World. You can read it online. I would say, if you want to get to the nitty-gritty, as I'm referring to it, just do a search on America, and you will come up to a section in the book where Robert U. Benson predicts, obviously, a war that is not World War I and not World War II, and he wrote this in 1904, to around there, 1909. He's talking about three spheres, once again, and the one that will threaten Europe would be the Asian Empire, and that it almost would be like a new Mongol invasion, if you will. And the only power that could step in between the salvation of Europe and the westward invasion was the United States. I would really ask people to read that. It's interesting. Benson was an Anglican turned Catholic priest. Brother was a Jesuit. I'll say no more. Also, remember Wells and the time machine. there seems to be something else going on there, too, that that I think also refers both to Orwell and Huxley. Because you have, that kind of lotus eater with that, the Eloy, I believe.
Eloy, right.
Yeah, and then you had the Morlocks. Now, the reason I'm saying this is that as I look around, and of course, being an old geezer now, I'm going to be grumpier than I ever was in my assessment. But I look at young people today, and they actually just seem like pleasure packages that don't really think too much past the ingredients.
You got it.
But now I'm wondering how you can get that those people actuated into, if you have to, a violent stage most likely meant for war. And here's where I'm going again. I know this is long-winded, but I think there is a method right now to this madness. I remember an exchange that took place, and you might too, John, because we lived during the time it happened. It was either Khrushchev coming over here or it was Gromyko. I can't remember which one. And it may have been the Glassboro, New Jersey visit. Not sure. But Khrushchev's statement, let's just say it was he. He said, you know, you Americans are so soft. You got your TVs and your swimming pools and your cars. And whoever was addressing him said, I tell you what, watch what happens when you try to take them away. All right. Now I'm thinking, Orwell and Huxley again, we may be in a Huxleyan medicated, isn't everything beautiful, pleasure me mama society. How do you get them to turn around and get into a war mode? They don't have to think. All they do is react to stimuli. So what I'm thinking about right now is you're going to see a situation where we may pass from this Huxleyan, brave new world, where's my soma, mama, into an unthinking, insensate body of people willing to fight. And that would also lead you through rabid nationalism. And on the other side, after the ashes have all fallen and the dust is cleared, we'll find ourselves in Orwell's world. Now, I know I said a lot about that, and John, I'm going to give it to you first and Gordon second. If that elicited any kind of response from you, no matter what it was, would you share that with us? Just don't say no.
Okay. That was a lot. I'm trying to...
I know.
Okay. The thing about Khrushchev and when the
exchange.
The exchange where, you know, they're going to fight to keep all this stuff, you know, it harkens back to a quote from Napoleon, who said, a man will fight harder for his interests than for his rights.
Hmm. Okay.
And, you know, it's almost the same thing, and your interests are all your crap. Now, but on the other hand, is all this crap, is it, you know, the kids today might want to fight for that, but has all this crap and all this sitting around in virtual reality, has it enervated these kids so much that they can't fight? Has it softened them so much mm-hmm. that they're unable to fight? You know, we're in a situation where we have a cadre of people who do go fight in these wars. They go back and deploy over and over again, sometimes as much as 7 or 8 times. Some men and women have been in the Middle East fighting on various wars. And most people have no clue. They have no experience with it. And so I really, you know, if they're intending that the United States be a source of soldiers for some future conflagration, well, they're going to have to make things bad here, I think, first,
mm-hmm.
before they'll get enough. I mean, right now we're sort of scraping by with a certain small percentage of Americans that are going to fight these wars, and we're going to need a lot more if there's going to be a giant worldwide conflagration. So that's why I say maybe that's why the American economy is being worn down. Maybe that's why mm-hmm. we're being impoverished here to prepare us for that. I don't know. Just speculation.
Are you done?
So that's
okay.
Basically what I'm done okay. about that, yeah.
All right. What about it, Gordon? What hit you, no matter what, you, if anything, you extracted from what I said in my screed?
Well, this is it's an interesting focal point to look at the mixture between the predictions or projections of Orwell and Huxley here, because John's right. The vast majority of young people, and I see them every day, work with them, the vast majority are soft and addicted to video games and soft living and eating junk food. And it's like George Carlin noted. They young people nowadays, they got their cell phones that can make flapjacks, so what do they care about protesting anything?
All right,
on the other hand, so and of course that's the Huxley side of it. On the other hand, what we also see, and this is the small cadre of young soldiers in America, young budding soldiers that I think John noted. On the other hand, what do you see in our movies nowadays and on television with the History Channel, and now we got the Military Channel, but the History Channel itself will have more shows about not only just warfare, but weaponry, shows about specific weaponry. And we see in our movies now a lot more violent and belligerently nationalistic movies, you know, Black Hawk Down and on. There's a lot more of those. You didn't see those in the 70s when I was a boy.
And
I remember.
Gordon, I don't watch the Military Channel, but I was visiting a friend who's really into it, so he said, you got to watch this. So we're watching it, and I'm realizing this is pure propaganda.
Yes.
I felt like I was back in Nazi Germany. I mean, this is just glorifying the military. I mean, there's nothing, you know, I was in the military myself, but I was amazed at the how they were glorifying our efforts in the Middle East, like Afghanistan, like everything is going hunky-dory and wonderful and the people are all on our side and we just need to get rid of these nasty Talibans and we're making a lot of progress. And I'm thinking, this is totally a mirror image of reality. And also, Gordon, I found an interesting thing about Orwell. You were talking about how we're being screwed up by junk food. You know, Orwell said one of the reasons to – I read it in a short essay by V.S. Pritchett. He told him when he talked to him that he said Orwell hated industrial capitalism because it fed its people so badly on ersatz food. And it demoralized them so much they could not cook.
Yeah. I got that. Boy, I read that's in an essay, and I forget which essay that is. I know what you mean. Yeah
it's V.S. Pritchett wrote a short 3-page essay on Orwell, who he knew, and I happened to come across that one, and I thought it was kind of amusing.
I remember back in the early 70s. When right around the gas crisis, it was probably 73 into 74. When, and if you think back, John, because again, you know, we were older than Gordon and more adult-like as far as our concerns, and there was talk about the fact that if this embargo continued, that our Seventh Fleet would be rendered useless, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember that being used as a chip to get America pissed off. To perhaps back a military incursion. It never came. However, what I'm looking at, if we're headed for a third world war, and in deference to you, John, I'd say, okay, maybe it isn't going to happen. But considering that it might, I would look at it in America, again, as telling the population, the reason why you're in such hurt is that China just wants to cash in a debt and wage economic war on us. You can also find Russia as the boogeyman because we're going to be told they're backing Iran. They're sending stuff, you know, nuclear materials. And then if you've noticed now, every so often when the gas spikes, into the conversation comes Iran. And I'm looking at this now. We're going to be 40 years down the road from the first time around, and I look at it as people being actuated in the United States once again. Because guess what, folks? All this stuff is not going to happen for you. Economically, China's trashing us. Gas is like $7 a gallon because of those damn old Iranians. I'm looking at that. Now, how do you sell a war in Russia and China? In China, it's like they just have to say, listen, we have to crush decadence. And I'm pretty sure they're going to use us as the poster boy. And I can see an army salivating to give us the ass kicking they think we deserve. With Russia, I think it's just the fact that if the United States is on the chessboard, which that means it would, then we don't want them around. So you could even just look at that as plain imperialism, which they're, I'm sure, upset about now because of our presence in certain republics that flank Russia. So I think...
Yeah, right. Russia is mainly concerned because they feel that we're hanging out in their what they consider to be their sphere of influence.
Yeah, and I think this is where we can look at this old bit about totalitarianism versus... you know, sybaritical lifestyle pleasures and such, you can use both situations to actuate populations for a war. But let's say there's not going to be one. And now we're going to go back to the questions I'm throwing at you both. And this one I'll give to you first, Gordon. Let's say we don't have a world war. Maybe we'll have some kind of cataclysm, but let's say there's no Third World War. When you look at Huxley's vision, when you look at Orwell's vision, could one of these two be a precursor to the other if civilizations are now on the path to decline? Would one of the visions give way to the other? That may seem a little enigmatic, but if you can work with that, go ahead, Gordon.
Boy.
Yeah, I know. It's a little out there. I admit.
There's either going to be another world war, or else I can't see how there won't be. But if there's not, then there would be a continuation for a long time, I would say, of the endless and multifarious small skirmishes all around the world, perpetual war for perpetual peace, as Orwell said. I would guess, boy, I know. Yeah, I would that lead to a more Huxleyan world after that?
Well, let me clarify this, and you take another shot at it, Gordon, and then John will be the beneficiary of listening to this. It seems to me that the way that it could work, and this is what I had in mind when I asked the question, I hope I didn't make it more subjective than it came out, but let's put it this way. If you want to cock somebody in the head, do you walk into the room part of the way, one hand behind your back with a hammer and say, come here, kid? Maybe not. Or you show them the hammer and say, come here, kid. Probably not. But if you showed them a lollipop or an apple and said, come here, kid, well, I think the person would be more inclined to go for the treat. That's why I'm wondering if we're not in a situation where whatever's going to happen, which is going to be on the ugly side of midnight, what we are being extended now is the bait. So I would say, in my mind, I'm saying it would be a Huxleyan environment prior to an Orwellian environment, which I think would probably be the last stage. Yes, no, or otherwise, Gordon, and then John will go after you.
Now, that's interesting. That's coming at it the other way. Wow. Well, I'd just like to hear John's.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I'd have to come out on the other side of the Visigoth analysis there. I really think that the Brave New World can only happen with a global government. And a global government will arise after the war after the stage of wars amongst these more totalitarian type dictatorships or totalitarian systems. And then once all that is sorted out, once that little dance of death is completed, for the last time, the sense of nationalism and patriotism is kicked out of people, then a global government could be instituted, which would then rely on genetics to maybe take out some aggressive genes so that we won't be so dangerous to the powers that be, or maybe the more sophisticated drugs will be put in place. You know, it's interesting when you watch TV now, and you see these drugs that are used for mood alters, and they're like combinations of two and three drugs together. You know, one takes the edge off, another one makes you a little mellow, the other one sort of eliminates psychotic episodes, and they're mixing them up. That's what I always imagined the Soma to be, and it would just sort of smooth everybody out, and then we're in the Brave New World, and where everyone gets along. And the thing about Huxley is, you know, Huxley, as I found out, as he was writing the book Brave New World, he had to add to it. When he finished it, he was appalled because he realized that he might like that world himself too much. He felt it was too utopian, and he felt that too many people would see it that way and might want to support it or help bring it about. So he actually set about making the world, that world he created, worse. he rewrote parts and he added parts to do that. And he was amazed. He said that's why he always felt that his world was the one that ultimately would prevail, because it was ultimately more pleasant. Because let's face it, Huxley, he enjoyed the finer things in life. You know, he enjoyed an Epicurean lifestyle. Mm-hmm. He enjoyed women, and he saw this world, which was probably a projection right from his own brain, where all women were available, and sex was a pastime that didn't, have any repercussions. The amusements, the touchy-feely movies, which was, as we head into a future with the holodeck experience probably coming within a couple of decades, that's, there it is. So, I forget where I was going with that, but, I'll just leave it at that. I think ultimately the Brave New World would logically come after the totalitarian state, because I don't think once you had the Brave New World, unless you see the leaders as being so evil they enjoy the boot in the face, they enjoy the torture, that they'd rather have a society like that. That might be the case, because there are people that can only be called evil that will enjoy torturing you. They will enjoy stomping your face down. They will enjoy keeping you in a cell, and they will enjoy executing you.
Okay.
So maybe that's the case. I don't know.
What about this? And this is something I've thought about as well, as far as the outcomes, probably long after we're dead. And I think back to Wells, and that is, we've heard so much about depopulation and how the elites, when they finally get to the point where they're running the show, maybe we've had depopulation through, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but this is their vision, that the war has decimated populations. You could also do it with a pandemic. If you look at World War I, you had the fight, you had the war first and then the pandemic later to pick off the weak who had been rendered either physically or otherwise impaired, and you want to get them out of the genetic system. If that's the case, then take a look at Wells. Do you keep the Eloi around, who, as both Huxley and Orwell would say, have to be plied with drugs or whatever to make their miserable existence worth living, if that's correct? I mean, at least enduring. All right, so where I'm going with this is, if you're going to have depopulation, if the elites only want enough around to do the wet work, then I can see a situation where, as you had said, John, that now we're into a Huxleyan situation, because these guys got to do really crummy stuff. And so, hey, look, whatever you need to do in your downtime, go ahead and do it, whether it's soma, whether it's sex. Orwell said the same thing, whether it's gin or something. If we're going for a depopulation, keep as few humans around as possible, I would think probably there's no reason for totalitarianism, because there's not enough numbers anywhere of dissenters. And so you just keep them happy while they live their miserable and no doubt short life. I'm going to just ask you to go yay and nay on that, John, and then over to Gordon.
Yay.
Okay. you did as I asked. Thank you. What about it, Gordon?
If we go
to a minimum amount of population, as we heard, that's what they want. Do we just keep everybody happy? Put the virtual reality helmet on, get screwed 17 times and then come back when you're done.
Yes, and since we're talking about depopulation, if I could take an opportunity to ask John a question, and this, you could help me out, John, because this is one of the things that always honestly perturbed me about Aldous Huxley, the fact that his brother Julian was head of UNESCO, and
sure.
UNESCO, yeah. And UNESCO is one of the leading eugenics sponsors in the world.
Aldous Huxley, when it came to eugenics, Huxley said, in theory, it might be a good idea, but he felt that in practice it would be abused. So he was against eugenics.
What about?
Yeah, okay.
Let me throw this out there quickly. What about the grandfather, Thomas? To me, he was probably deeper down that road and also perhaps more about survival of the fittest than Darwin was. And there seems to be a continuum that used... You have Thomas Huxley, and then you come down to the brothers, Aldous and Julian. somewhere in the middle, and I don't know who I'm forgetting, whether it was, there had to be a generation in there that ran with Huxley's ideas, Thomas's, and then gave them in a continuum to the two brothers. And I'm wondering if that's Wells, I'm not sure, or if it was Darwin and Galton, I'm not quite sure, although Wells would be in that cohort as well. So what I'm asking you about, when you go back to two more generations before the brothers, are we looking at Thomas, who might have been the most, shall we say, formidable and somewhat sinister personage when it came to a depopulation?
You know, I don't know about that. I don't know. You know, I know that they were the Huxley family. Thomas Henry Huxley was called Darwin's bulldog, I believe.
Yep.
And so they believed in evolution. You know, I'd tell the truth. I believe in evolution too. I think it makes sense. As that's my anthropology degree speaking, and though I have studied it, I think it's real. You know, maybe sure, there are holes in the theory, but I think finding an error in theory doesn't disprove the theory. It just means you found an error in the theory. But I also feel that evolution is probably directed by the higher power. That's what I believe. I don't think evolution is the system that God has instituted to develop life on the planet. So I don't feel it's a brutish survival of the fittest thing. I think it's directed. I think, man, for all of his flaws and faults and problems, is a very interesting thing. And I don't think we arrived here by accident. So
well,
that's
tell
just
you,
my opinion.
The danger may be in how it's used, like anything that Americans – great, that's a Freudian – that human beings are given. You can use it for good, you can use it for ill, or you can take and run with it for a very saturnine end. With regard to where they were – what they were thinking about, and I'm only going to state this now, and I'm going to move into something with regard to the Fabians. If you go to Galton.org and you click on – there's something there. I'm doing this cold, okay? I got my screen up, and I'm not going to mess with it right now. Go to Galton.org. You can click on, like, quarterlies or conferences. There was one, I think, in 1904. Just click on that, and you will see Galton is there and Wells is there with a couple others. I think even Russell is there. The reason I say it is because there are some shocking statements made. Galton seems to be the softer one who says, listen, a selective breeding, that's where it's at. Wells, I would say the tenor of the moment that I got from what Wells spoke about, and there's a transcript for all this, he almost like he bitch-slapped Galton and said, slay the hindmost, that's what you do. And then you got Russell, and this is what brings us into the Fabians, because and you're going to give us your take on it, John, and also Gordon. But what bothered me about Russell, especially in that one book, An Intelligent Women's Guide to Socialism, in the epilogue he says, look, here's where it's going to be, folks. You're going to be fed, you're going to be clothed, you're going to be housed, and you're going to work. And if you have not the industry for such, you can be killed in a kindly manner. And I'm like, is that right? Okay. And so when I look at that as the outcome, that's what I see out of all this. I'm not attaching it necessarily to Huxley or Orwell. But, boy, I'll tell you what, there was something going around, like I said, in and around London at that time that would give rise to these people, and these just seemingly – back of the hand type of statements that carry with it, life and death. So at any rate, I don't know if you want to speak to that or not. That was just a commentary on my part, and we're going to head over to the Fabian socialists. But go ahead, John, and then Gordon, you get the second shot.
Yeah, you know, Bertrand Russell is a very interesting person. I really need to study up on him a little more.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. I'm sorry. I'm going to throw it to you again. It was George Bernard Shaw.
Oh, George Bernard Shaw.
Yeah, Russell was in there, no doubt about it. But it was Shaw who came out with those remarks and wrote that book, The Intelligent Women's Guide.
Well, the thing about Shaw, you have to wonder just how serious he is sometimes. Sometimes he's saying things for effect. He was a satirist. He wrote drama. He was, if you've seen any of his plays, he will say extreme things to effect. It's not necessarily his voice. So I don't know where that quote comes from. I'd have to read it in context. But, you know, I'm not going to come out and defend Shaw or not. I know I've seen a couple of his plays, and I've enjoyed them. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, I'll tell you what. That is in the epilogue of the Women's Intelligent Guide to Socialism. I'm sorry I screwed that up. It was George Bernard Shaw. I mix them up all the time. But that statement was so crass. I was like, what?
It is crass. It's almost to the point where I think maybe it's like he's just...
Shock value?
He's just trying to be satirical. Maybe he's trying to mock someone else with the statement. But I'm not sure. I'll have to see it. I'll have to look it up.
Gordon, hold on a second. Just hold on to your thought. I want to tell everybody, since I went ahead and did it, you go to Galton.org, you click on eugenics, and let's see. At any rate, you click on eugenics, and then you'll get to the meeting, the conference, in which all statements were transcribed in this particular quarterly. And I'm sorry I interrupted you, but Gordon, go ahead with that.
The fact that there could be so many intellectual luminaries in London at that period making statements like that, and those guys had power, had influence. The fact that there could be so many of them and making such statements and actually believing such things, it gives further corroboration to what I believe and have read in a few sources, that those people, those Fabians who believed such things and made such statements, they were the real target of the satire in 1984. Orwell broke with the Fabians. He got a whiff of what they were about, and he no longer wanted any part of it.
John, you and I have exchanged emails with regard to the Fabians.
Right.
And I think what you were telling me was that you didn't necessarily think that what they had in mind for the running of the world was the nicest thing, but that it would be effective. And I may have gotten
that
wrong.
Yeah, the thing about the Fabians let's see what the Fabian socialists were. The original Fabius Cunctator was a Roman general. Well, basically, Hannibal had gotten into Italy during the time of the Roman Republic, and he was kicking ass. Every general the Romans sent after him would try to have a big set-piece battle with him, and they'd basically lose the legions, right? So Fabius Cunctator said, I'm going to try something different, delaying tactics. I'll just wear him out, you know, a little rope-a-dope. I'll keep him on the run. I'll try to cut off his lines of supply. I'll try to starve him out. I will never have a set battle with him because he's too good.
Nip a baggage train.
And basically just use time. So he would, Cunctator means delayer. So that's what he did. And over the years, Hannibal got weaker and weaker, and finally he was conquered. He was finally defeated, mainly through, you know, the effect of time, and, you know, just things happen, and he lost troops, just he couldn't get resupplied, and that's how they did it. So the Fabian socialists took the name the Fabians, because also in later on in Roman history, the Fabian family became famous as those who catered to the mob and to the average person. You know, they were patricians themselves, but they would use the mob and try to do things for them to get power for themselves. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but so the Fabians were known as almost socialists as far as you could go in ancient Rome. You know, bread and circuses and things like that, and getting more political representation for the average person rather than just the patricians. So, of course, the rest of the Senate believed they were traitors, but they felt it had to be done because, or there'd be problems if you don't have the people on your side, who's going to fight your wars? Although at that time, you had to be a Roman citizen. You had to be basically be a landholder to even be in the army till later on, but that's another story. So the Fabian socialists said, we want to have social, we want, now I'm a little skeptical on how serious they were about this. Because here's what I'm getting at. The Fabian socialists said, number one, we want to avoid a violent revolution. Because what happens in a violent revolution? The powers that be, the leaders and the ruling class ends up hanging from a lamppost. Now, that wasn't something that the ruling class wanted to see. And they felt, they knew things were bad when they were Fabian Socialists. This is the height of the Industrial Revolution, and people were in these dank, dark, horrible factories working. Like I have a quote from Orwell, who in one of his essays cites Huxley, and he said, as Mr. Huxley has truly remarked, a dark satanic mill ought to look like a dark satanic mill and not like the temple of mysterious and splendid gods. But at the time, the country was full of dark satanic mills and child labor and people emaciated and dying in the streets. And the Fabian Socialists said, we've got to give the people something, else we could end up at the wrong end of a revolution. So they said, we are going to, and this is how the Labor Party was born, we are going to institute socialist reforms. So over the time, they had, you know, they ended up with national health care. They ended up with pensions, basic welfare programs for people that needed it. And they felt that this way they could avoid the revolution. So they just felt, they, as opposed to their Tory counterparts who just didn't want to give up anything, they felt that by giving something, they could avoid something even worse and also maintain power. They felt the ruling class could still keep their power, and as we've seen, that's exactly what's happened in England. And as time has gone on, and they're starting to remove some of the things they gave the people. They're saying, they're citing costs. They can't afford it anymore. And why can't they afford it? Because, you know, like so many other places, the jobs have disappeared. So it just, that's what the Fabian Socialists were about. They just felt that they wanted to avoid a violent revolution by throwing a few bones to the people, and in the end, the bones could be withdrawn once the people were used to a certain way of life. And now that we have a system with more better techniques of social control, maybe they don't need to give up so much. Maybe they feel now they have, you know, like you think we have cameras in this country. In England, every street corner has a camera. You can't walk around without being on a camera somewhere. So it's pretty hard to have a violent revolution these days in jolly old England. So, you know, things are changing back maybe. And so that's what the Fabian Socialists were about.
Gordon, any comments?
Yeah, I agree with what John just said, that the fact that we are under such surveillance, and there are, and with the mind-numbing drugs and the techno-gadgets, they really don't need to give up very much anymore. But early on, at the point where they were willing to give up more, I'd say even early on there was a tendency, like any group that tends to be at the vanguard of society, they're going to look out for themselves. And even the Fabians, even early on, were doing that. And one thing I'll cite for that is George Bernard Shaw. He was originally indigent, poor. He was a Fabian then, but unlike most of the other Fabians, he was not very well off. But he married a very rich woman and got part of her dowry, obviously. And it was after that marriage that his plays and everything else he wrote began to sell well. And what you can note is, although the Fabians in their economic program marked everything for nationalization, was it to each his own, or to what was the Marxist statement? From each according to his means, to each according to his needs, whatever.
From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs.
Thank you, John. But two of the things that were not marked for nationalization were royalties and dowries.
All right.
Well, the thing is, like I say, I think the Fabian Socialists, I think their ultimate goal was to create, you know, they said they were going to give these socialists, and I think probably many of them were sincere in creating these socialist benefits for the people. But in the end, all they actually accomplished was creating a more and more powerful central government, which could then be used to maintain itself. and make it even more difficult to overthrow. I mean, a violent revolution in 19th century England would have been a lot easier than it is today. In fact, today I would say it's almost impossible. But you never know. Things change. Same in this country. I really don't see much chance of any kind of a revolution, despite what a lot of people think.
Another reason for that is the weaponry that is possessed by the leaders, the government, the military of the governments. And that was that's talked about in George Orwell's essay, You and the Atomic Bomb, from 1945. He noted throughout history when the leading weaponry technology at any given time was simple to make so that the peasantry could make it, you could have successful revolutions. But if the highest technological weaponry was something that cost a lot to make and was too sophisticated to make, you're at a period of despotic stasis. There will be no revolution. And he said, we've got battleships now and the atomic bomb, and we're not going to have any more revolutions, not for a long time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right.
What about this? The other day, I caught probably two-thirds of a movie. I don't know if you folks have seen it, entitled Fidel. And you can imagine that it takes you through his early days, etc. At the time, they wanted to overthrow Batista, and they had a couple of failed attempts. Things weren't working out, etc. But there was an exchange between Fidel and I forget who, and said, you have to give it all up. You've got to give everything up. You have to have a clean break with the past. And I listened to that, and I said, yeah, that's true. You got to torch it all. You got to be willing to give it up, all of it. What I see happening now in the United States, and I think this is very clever, if in fact it's a considered movement, and it is meant to be, and in fact is successful, and that's this. Think about, let's just take two examples. Think about the Tea Party. They like to be touted as grassroots, like it really can work, but it's not grassroots. They like to be called grassroots because of the image that you get from this. Like, yeah, it's just people rolling up their arms, just everyday people. That thing is funded heavily, and it got right to the front of the food line. And now they've got themselves this little phalanx, I guess, either inside or an appendage on mainstream Republican Party. All right, now just hold that there. Now, all of us are aware of Alex Jones and the Patriots in America and all that other stuff. You know, one of my pet peeves is the fact that they keep on saying they got the NWO on the run. And I'm like, well, can you tell me how that happened? What are you using as victories? What's going on here? Actually, nothing except speaking it. But what Jones did as a leader of this thing is he got everybody back into the system to see if they could get good government by the ballot. And, of course, that was concomitant with Ron Paul's appearance. So here's my point. You've taken two types of, shall we say, discontented groups, and you've put them back in the system to try to fix what is corrupt from within the corruption. And all it's produced, as far as I can see, is a stasis. It's not going to change.
Well, I think you're right. I think what they've tried to do is co-opt people who might actually want to go out and change things and co-opt them by making them think they're actually doing something to change things when, in fact, they're not. I mean, people have been convinced that government is the enemy, and in some ways it is. But I think government is the enemy in as much as it's been taken over by forces, powerful forces, wealthy forces, giant corporations, and rich people. Gordon, you've mentioned the book The Rich and the Super Rich in the past, and that's a wonderful book. I read that book when it came out many years ago, and I was amazed.
I saw your review on Amazon.
you saw it. I was amazed that it had so little impact on the world and on the country. It was like the book came and went.
I don't think it's coincidence that it's out of print.
Yeah, it's hard to find. Although you can, I just got a new hardback copy a couple of years ago from Amazon. I used one for a reasonable price. I wore out my paperback, but yeah, that's a great book. But it's these Tea Party types are being manipulated by these power elites as these old families that have it all. I mean, they have so much power hidden away in foundations and corporations, in just family ties, the old club, that they're just being played like violins. That, you know, and they think government is the enemy. Actually, government is probably the only defense we've had against these kind of people, because without government, it would just be a totally feudal society. And these forces recognize that. I'm not saying government is a wonderful thing, but I'm saying, in as much as it isn't good or it isn't working for us, it's because it's controlled by others that have inordinate control. Okay. And so I'll get off my soapbox on that.
Waiting to